Hello and welcome back to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and joining me this week, as ever, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And GB News' Charlie Peters.
Hey, mate.
So plenty to talk about today. We'll be talking about some of the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic protest camps that are spreading across US campuses. We'll discuss the collapse of the SNP Green Coalition government and Joe Lycett's dreadful take on cancel culture. But before we kick off, I just wanted to remind everyone at home that Spike's internship program is now accepting applications. Tom and Charlie, you were both interns, yeah. So clearly you can go places with this scheme.
Absolutely.
So the deadline for that is Sunday, the 19th of May, and you can find out more by going to spiked-online.com/interns. So for the past week or so, it started on Wednesday. Columbia University in New York was taken over by a Gaza solidarity camp. These types of kind of occupation protests or camps have started taking over other US universities. There's been some quite severe police crackdowns on them. But also, notably, these haven't just been normal protests, Tom, have they? There's been a lot of anti-Semitic intimidation, some very questionable chanting. What have you made of this?
Well, I've been quite struck by the desperation to present this as just like any other form of student protest. The line that seems to be trotted out by a lot of the apologists for what's going on many American university campuses is this is what students have always done. They've always been involved in radical causes. They've always done occupations. They've always done protests. And I think really, first of all, that's just completely wrong. I mean, first of all, to compare what's going on these campuses where we've seen, for instance, at Columbia, people shouting, go back to Poland at Ashkenazi Jews, or in one instance where there was a group of Jewish students who on campus, almost as a little counter demonstration, were flying Israeli flags and the American flag. Someone stood in front of them with a sign that says the Al-Qassam Brigade's next target, pointing towards them, the Al-Qassam Brigade being the military wing of Hamas, slogans openly calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. Show me a protest in the 1970s or in the 1960s in which you had racist invective being hurled at people. And you can make that comparison, but I think there is no comparison whatsoever. I've found the nothing to see here tendency really dispiriting. What anti-Semitism? Really, really unfortunate and strange. And you get bound up in these ridiculous arguments. Are you saying all of these people are anti-Semitic? Of course not. But it's quite clearly that there's an atmosphere which has been created in which extreme, almost quite explicit anti-Semitism has become completely permissible.
Yeah.
We should get into, and I'm sure we will, the points about the ridiculous heavy-handed response to this at various universities and the free speech arguments that have been aired in relation to this, sometimes sincerely, often somewhat cynically, I would say. But at the same time, you can't get away from the fact that university students at elite American universities, what people would consider to be the real kind of higher institutions of Western civilization, if you want to put that kind of point on it, have become cauldrons of this unvarnished bigotry, not just towards Israel, but towards Jewish students at those universities. So the nothing to see here approach, I think, is almost as chilling as some of the horrendous things that we've seen said and chanted on these particular protests.
Definitely. And in case anyone's any doubt about what's going on, let's have a quick look at a clip. Charlie, I mean, what do you make of the way that this kind of sort of anti-Semitic invective, I guess, has just become sort of normalised, you know, because this hasn't come from a vacuum. This isn't the first example of it, but it just seems like the most extreme example of it.
Well, I suppose, first and foremost, it's in reaction to the ongoing war. And it's important to tie it to the situation that's unfolding in Gaza and across the wider Middle East. And I think much of the fact that these sorts of demonstrations and protests have been permitted by not only authorities, but also fellow citizens, for the most part, people have by and large not really opposed them vocally, perhaps due to fear to their own harsh response. But one of the reasons why this has gone on is because Israel has so appallingly lost the moral case in its own messaging for its war. It's really struggling to convince the world that it needs to carry out this mission to destroy Hamas. It's really losing in the battle of public opinion. Its weapons may be stronger than those of Hamas and Hezbollah, even though they've got, you know, great defensive capabilities. But one area where they've completely fallen apart is the information war, their ability to explain what they're doing. And that in turn, I think, has incentivized or liberated a sensation among a lot of protesters against that war where they think the world is with us. And that has allowed, I think, some of the more extremist elements to come forward. And I think it's also worth remembering why we're seeing so many of these anti-Semitic, let's be frank, elements of these protests, like some of the footage we've just seen in the States, is because of the First Amendment, right? They have protection to say some of those extreme things. A lot of them are borderline cases calling for violent acts to occur. That, of course, has an additional legal limit in the States. But I think what we've seen in Britain, even though there is potentially a larger portion of our population that is glued to the Palestinian cause, we haven't seen as extreme as protests as we're seeing on these campuses, perhaps in part because there is that fear that the law might actually finally do something if they cross that line. There have been a few test cases that have been put forward where the Met in particular have failed, others where they've, you know, gone through and made charges. But in the States, there's so much broader protection available for this kind of speech. Maybe in some cases, that's a good thing. That exposes the true nature of some elements of this protest. But I think it's also at the same time revealed some really dark elements that authorities and indeed ordinary people have failed to crack down on. There is one thing that I think we should stress on this, though. At the same time, as all of this is going on, you know, perhaps, Tom, I'm not quite so far as you are on this point. I do think there is a concern that people might overreact to some degree and say that, I think Columbia University, you know, the chief rabbis there said that if you're Jewish, you should go home. There are some students who have said no to that and have said that actually they're going to go back to class next week. They're going to see out the semester. They're not going to go away forever. And, you know, I was speaking to some Jewish friends this week. You know, what would you do if it was happening to a London campus or if this was happening at your university when you were still a student? Would you still go to uni? They all said, yeah. You know, and actually, the worst thing that you could do in this point is to be intimidated by a movement that by and large isn't actually physically menacing. One thing that has been quite remarkable about how impressive people have mobilized for the Palestinian movement since this war started is how it's captured all sorts of other left-wing movements with no relation to the Palestinian cause. A writer from the Telegraph pointed out this week that one protester had a t-shirt on saying "Fatties for Palestine," saying that fat phobia and Palestine are a cause that's aligned. A few weeks ago in GB News, we revealed a group called Youth Demand, which is an offshoot of Just Stop Oil. It's a youth group which is now, because nobody cares about environmentalism right now, it's kind of in the back foot. They're going all in on the Palestinian issue instead.
You've seen drag queens for Palestine.
Well, there we go.
I don't think that's that surprising. I mean, it's quite clear that a lot of these causes are drawing from the same well. Mm. I mean, there's a lot I want to come back on that. First of all, I think on the question of Israel, I think I understand the point about, you know, have they lost the argument or lost the information or whatever. They lost it to begin with because of the fact that there was this baseline assumption that any kind of response was illegitimate, that any kind of response would be genocidal rather than defensive. The fact that we saw in this country marches and demonstrations celebrating October 7th before there was even any response to it. I mean, the anti-Semitic violence and attacks and invective and incidents that are tracked by people like the Community Security Trust peaked before the war began properly. So I think that tells you everything you need to know really about what's guiding this. But I think it's been clear for some time, and this is why Western elite academia have become such a hotbed of Israelophobia to just straightforward anti-Semitism, is because of the fact that all of these kinds of tendencies, whether it's the identity politics, whether it's the general kind of faux anti-imperialism, but is really just a kind of anti-Western tendency, responds very well to these kinds of causes and arguments, not because they see it as a national liberation struggle, because it kind of expresses all of those forms of self-loathing, all of that anti-Western sentiment, and also the way in which anti-Semitism has been essentially given a new lease of life within that whole political ideology. So in a way, it's not surprising at all. And yes, I mean, most of these protesters, you know, don't really pose much of a threat to a wet paper bag. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I thought it's been interesting is the desperation to try and always make these distinctions. Oh, it's these outside agitators. It's people outside the gates at Columbia, or it's a few bad apples within it. Mm. The fact that the mainstream of the protests, if you really wanted to be taken seriously as a genuinely progressive anti-racist movement, whatever, you think the first thing you would do is firstly say anyone who's going to be screaming this kind of invective has nothing to do with us. You know, you would be making very clear that more than anything else, you condemn what Hamas did on October the 7th. That's not there at all. If anything, quite the opposite. And also, I think it's worth saying that people try and bracket the kind of anti-Semitic and anti-Israel thing. We all know that those lines are blurred to the point of uselessness. I mean, the fact that you've got people going around shouting about, we don't want two states, we want all of it, which is a call for the ethnic cleansing of Israel, effectively. Yeah. How do you expect your average Israeli Jew to exist under a kind of Hamas or similar style Islamist leadership? It's not going
to
go particularly
well. That was put to one of the protesters in the Atlantic, and she said, well, maybe Jewish people, Israelis should check their privilege. If they don't want to. They should just deal with living under a terrorist occupation.
But I suppose the point is that they've created an environment in which this stuff is permissible, in which this stuff is kind of encouraged. Even the way in which various Columbia academics staged a walkout after 100 people were arrested when they first tried to get the encampment underway. Now, obviously, there's the civil liberties and the academic freedom and the free speech on campus aspect to that, which obviously, if you're engaged in peaceful protest, if you're engaged in politics, if you're engaged in making arguments, doesn't matter how disgusting, racist, bigoted those are, those should be protected, and those are protected on American university campuses. But it's quite clear that that's not what this is, because those academics or a lot of those other protesters are not saying, look, these people are extreme, they've got nothing to do with us, but they have a right to say it. They're basically presenting them as an unalloyed good, and if anything, you should be on their side. So yes, there is a free speech part to this argument. I think the way in which Columbia quite rashly responded to this by calling in the police was a bad idea. It seemingly tripled the encampment overnight, so that didn't necessarily work. And at other campuses, you're seeing more of a crackdown, which is deeply concerning. But at the same time, the complete absence of any condemnation, the complete absence of any, not a call for them to be censored, but just to point out and for there to be even space to properly demonstrate against them has been completely limited. And when Jewish students have tried to do it, they found themselves being followed around campus, blocked from moving. They try to walk towards the encampment, people shout out things like, we've got some Zionists here. We know what that is. That's just a code word for saying some Jews have turned up, and we shouldn't be shy about pointing that out.
And Charlie, I mean, what have you made of, I mean, there has been, to a certain extent, there's these two reactions. One is to sort of ignore it, to pretend you know, there's no anti-Semitism here. The other has been from many right-wing figures in America to call in the National Guard, the army.
I mean, there was an element of the Texas state arm that I didn't know existed until yesterday, the public safety department or something. Needless to say, they're armed. And they turned up on horses to crack down at UT Austin, is it? I think where they are. Yeah, so there was a ginormous response there. And that was the most significant clashes that we've seen so far, I think. That is going, as you said, with the encampment growing overnight in Columbia, I think the same thing is going to happen in UT. They're going to see more people turning up now to defy that force.
Yeah,
I don't think it's a positive strategy if you want to crack down on a protest like that. But if there's no way of removing those people from what is essentially private property a lot of the time, I mean, a lot of these students, they're not just standing in the middle of squares, they're also taking over buildings. I mean, what other universities in recent months have said, if you don't leave the building, will just remove you from the university. You know, you're no longer part of this course. I mean, is that a threat to academic freedom?
Of course it isn't. That's what I mean, the free speech argument coming from those people is ridiculous anyway. These are people who, you know, 6 weeks ago were saying that this academic had to be handed off of campus because they didn't respect so-and-so's pronouns or whatever. So this is obvious cynical bollocks as far as they're concerned. But also, you know, this is the point about if you're engaged in campus protests, you know, you can't occupy a certain place indefinitely and not expect a response. The point of civil disobedience is that you are breaking the rules.
Yeah.
And it's absurd for them to then turn around and say, because we haven't been entirely indulged, therefore this is a threat to free speech. So of course, there's one needs to be straightforward about this. Free speech is a fundamental liberty, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that you're allowed to engage in violence. It doesn't mean you're allowed to engage in harassment. It doesn't mean you're allowed to stop people moving around campus. It doesn't mean that you're allowed to, as happened at Berkeley a couple of weeks ago, when there's a pro-Israel Jewish society run event, bang on the window, smash windows, and force them to leave throughout the back, you know, through the, have to be escorted out through the back door. That is not freedom of speech.
It's not, can't we understand to break that. Other laws.
No. And to engage in action. And yet I think it's been fascinating how you've got these people who've never had anything to say about free speech other than to put it in quote marks and pretend that it's just nonsense, now claiming free speech as carte blanche to engage in harassment, sometimes violence, and also disruption, which is the thing. If you're going to stage a protest, I mean, that, I think that speaks to the entitlement amongst these students and the fact that they have been, in some instances and on previous issues, kind of quite indulged by a university establishment who are often quite kind of scared of them because they were just terrified of being called names, not because they pose a physical threat.
Or agree with them.
or agree with them, as is often the case, where they kind of expect that they can, again, indulge with this with no pushback. But as I say, the point of civil disobedience is because you expect there to be some sort of consequence. You're there to make your point regardless and so on. So I think part of this is a lot of this is just disingenuous. It's not to say there aren't free speech concerns here. Of course there are. The fact that at UT you saw that even local journalists being knocked over and arrested for no obvious reason, and people are allowed to engage in peaceful protest. But I think in a way that's what makes it all the more unfortunate that by coming down as hard as some of these universities have, they've given the free speech mantle to people who really don't deserve it.
Definitely. And finally, I mean, just want to say something about DEI. I mean, there's a lot of suggestion that actually, you know, this kind of anti-racist politics that is very much a part of the university bureaucracy, in this instance at least, is clearly part of the problem. It doesn't, you know, it's almost essentially the language of DEI is being used against Jewish students.
Well, there is legitimate criticism to be making about Israel with regards to policies that it has in terms of integration, how it permits nationality. But I think to go the one step further and describe everyone assigned or aligned with Israel as a colonizer is a clear, you know, co-opting of that language to embark on often extremely hateful, denigratory and dangerous rhetoric that we've seen on many of these campus protests. And it is reflective, I think, of a wider experience that many people have at universities these days, which is, of course, that the oppressor versus the oppressed, the colonizer, the colonized. That worldview encapsulates or is attempts to encapsulate all parts of world politics. Every story has to include it where possible. And I think they see these puzzle pieces fitting in very neatly. There's a lack of nuance. And also, I think they detect a great degree of international weakness on this issue at the same time as realizing that America really matters in this debate. And so they can put on quite a lot of pressure and get an enormous amount of attention at a time when leaders in the US aren't demonstrating the level of support for Israel's mission and indeed existence as they have in the past. There is a now quite desperate move, I think, coming out of Israel to try and compare their war to the US-led intervention in Iraq and Syria to defeat ISIS. They're saying that Hamas are their ISIS, and they want other people to think and feel like that. Ben Wallace, who was a defense secretary for much of the assault on, you know, Mosul and northern Iraq and Raqqa and Syria, etc., described Israel as potentially engaging in a killing rage last year. And Israel is saying, well, you know, you're pointing out this, but at the same time, when you were in charge of your own military fighting against an Islamist foe, you had a potentially worse enemy to civilian casualty ratio. Yeah. You wiped out the vast majority of the buildings in these cities under American command. Basic utilities are not there years later. If lots of these protesters see the way that world leaders aren't able to back up those arguments when another power does it, I think that they are very easily emboldened to push a step further. And they do sense that weakness and a failure to match the level of support they have in the past. And I think that more than anything, while all the politicians are very keen to criticize, we've seen Mike Johnson do it as well, go there and call for the National Guard, President Biden calling them anti-Semitic, obviously the Israelis doing the same. Part of the reason why these protests have popped up in such a way is because they can smell blood. They know that their political leaders are weak on this at the moment.
Yeah. Tom, do you want to add anything?
I think that's a really important point, is to the extent to which a signal has been sent to these students that they're on the right side of history. Which is so blood-curdling because it's the opposite is such the case. I mean, the open expressions of support for barbarism that have taken place. I mean, it would be one thing if some of them were downplaying what happened on October 7th, but just openly celebrating Hamas. The way in which kind of making these references to the Al-Qassam Brigade and whatever has just become this kind of mean taunt that happens on an American campus, I think tells you how deep the rot runs. And it makes me think, it is almost regardless of how well or not prosecuted this war is, we would have had something like this happen. Yes, it's become a big focus. Yes, it's become the current thing amongst a bunch of students who probably haven't even opened one book about this particular subject. But it just shows that they're drawing from a very deep well of identity politics, anti-Westernism, and ultimately anti-Semitism. And I think to pretend like they're just good kids who have been led a bit astray is not to take them seriously, and also not to take seriously the scale of the problem that's built up in basically kind of American and Western intelligentsia. They're just, as ever, the students are just the more radical exponent of that. They just happen to live in a time in which what they are the most radical exponent of is the most putrid, barbaric ideology possible.
Taking care of yourself should be straightforward. But with tons of conflicting advice out there, it's no surprise that most of us find it difficult to feel our best. Keeping up with it all can often feel overwhelming. Well, thanks to AG1, staying healthier has just become a whole lot easier. AG1 is a daily nutrition supplement that makes healthy living simple. Just one scoop contains 70 high-quality ingredients that work together to meet your nutritional needs. These days, I'm drinking AG1 alongside my morning coffee. All I do is mix one scoop with water, and in less than a minute, I've got everything I need to kick off the rest of my day. The single scoop contains gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, high-quality mushrooms, and more. Some ingredients, like pantothenic acid, help you stay mentally focused throughout the day without having to rely on coffee. Other ingredients, like copper, help unlock all the nutrition and energy from the food you eat. For me, though, one of the most surprising benefits of AG1 is how much it can improve your heart health. The B vitamins in AG1 help to keep those all-important red blood cells pumping through your body. AG1 is also used by Olympians, footballers, and F1 drivers, so you can rest easy knowing that you're drinking the supplement of champions. And if that isn't good enough for you, plenty of AG1 staff have convinced their own parents to take it, so you'll be hard-pressed to find a more trustworthy brand. So, if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription. Just go to drinkag1.com/spiked. That's drinkag1.com/spiked. Right, so Hamza Yousef has pulled the plug on the SNP Green Coalition. I don't think anyone is going to miss this particular government. I mean, it's hard to pinpoint exactly what led to the collapse. Most likely, it seems the Greens were most annoyed by the Scottish government's or by the SNP's abandonment of quite stringent climate targets. They were promising initially to cut carbon emissions by 75%, I think, by 2030. It seems as if the SNP are quietly annoyed by the Greens' almost rejection of the CAS review. So there's a sort of gender aspect to this. That's certainly what is being suggested on in some quarters. What have you made of this collapse? You certainly won't miss them, will you?
No, I will in a way. I think the Scottish Greens are a fantastic boost to most of the causes that I care about. I mean, there's this bizarre selection of people, Patrick Harvey and Lorna Slater, and is it Maggie Chapman?
Yeah.
Who is someone who's on record as saying that both the eight-year-olds should be able to change their sex and also that Hamas are all right, really. That's not exactly what she said, I should clarify. But, you know, making excuses.
October 7th was an act of decolonisation rather than terrorism.
And I'm sure she...
Don't believe the media who say it's terrorism.
And I'm sure she claimed that she just didn't realise what had properly happened and whatever, but, you know. The record is what the record is, Maggie. But I think that they've been a fantastic boon to a lot of the causes that we care about. So I'm sad to see them go. They're a bizarre parade of people. But it is, no, it's interesting because I think it's the coalition, I mean, it's not a coalition government, but the coalition agreement that they had, I think was quite striking as far as the willingness of the SNP to almost prioritise this project of kind of social engineering over what they're supposedly set up to do. Now, obviously, they share the cause of independence with the Scottish Greens, but at the same time, the fact that they got so bogged down in gender self-ID, in green politics to a certain extent, despite the fact that to be so pro-green and to be engaged in a campaign for Scottish independence makes absolutely no sense when the whole economic case for it was based on the oil and gas reserves. Makes no sense whatsoever. But I think it's just an interesting reminder that that whole kind of period of SNP rule propped up by the Greens, sometimes formally, sometimes informally over recent years, was that they so often took their eye off the ball because whilst they were nominally about liberating Scots, really their main project was remaking them in their own image. So it's an interesting point. I mean, it is just entire, the fact that you've got, the fact that it's gotten to the point with the gender issue that even as thoroughly up to their necks in gender ideology as the SNP are, they have to kind of cut loose the Greens because they're making them look bad. I think it's good at least that they're sensing which way the wind's blowing on these issues, even if it's far too late in the day.
Definitely. Charlie, what have you made of it?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a case of you hear a rumour that your girlfriend's going to dump you, so you quickly call her up and say, by the way, I'm not so keen on this. I mean, after the climate change panel, the committee that came out with that ruling, it seemed pretty obvious, according to the reporters up there, that this was coming.
Yeah.
But it points to the fact that the SNP at the moment aren't particularly good at politics, that they've done this, because it seems now most likely that there's going to be a vote of no confidence.
Yeah, probably next week.
And he might lose his seating as the first minister. And in a remarkable turn of events, the person who might hold the power here, because the Greens are likely to come out against him, is Ash Regan, the Albert MSP, who lost to Humza Yousaf in the first round of the election for the leadership last year.
Mm-hmm. Formerly the SNP, then defected.
Yeah, defected to Albert. Mm-hmm. And Humza Yousaf said at the time that she was no great loss.
Yeah.
And now she holds the key to whether or not he keeps his job, basically. And for that to happen in basically a year, to go from this great leadership moment to the person you booted coming through to return the favour, is a disaster from the SNP's perspective. What happened in Scotland during the latter half of the SNP's reign, what happens next we'll see, but you know, an early election is likely, I think, after this vote of no confidence. But what happens later, what's happened the latter half, I think is going to be quite indicative of what might happen to England after the next general election, because the SNP's tried to do quite a lot of politics with not a lot of money. And if the polling is right and we're going to have a Labour government in the UK at the next election, I think they're going to find themselves in a similar position. And instead of having the economic and financial manoeuvrability to pull the strings that they want to achieve the economic ambitions they have, they might instead be restricted to culture war politicking, which, as both of you can attest, there's been no shortage of from the SNP since they took power.
And Scottish Labour has supported every move
turn
on that front.
Every
the Hate Crime Act, the Gender Recognition Bill, Anas Sawa now trying to distance himself from that stuff. I mean, even, and what's funny is, you remember people, lots of people complained to the police about Humza's speech, you know, where he said, listed out all these senior Scottish jobs and then said white after them. Mm. Anas Sawa gave almost exactly the same speech. It's absolutely bizarre. So you're right, Charlie. I think, you know, if we see Keir Starmer, I mean, we know that Keir Starmer tries his best to distance himself from those culture war things, but
having taken the knee himself at the peak of that issue.
Yeah, he's naturally inclined to want to go there and then has to be dragged back kicking and screaming when he sees the, hears about what the focus groups.
And there are so many potential elements here that could shift Starmer in certain ways should he become prime minister. But I think it's certainly the case that his premiership at the start, if the polling is right, might be quite weak. He might be very reliant on support from the left of his party. And also what happens on the other side of the house, should the next leader of the Conservative Party be rather similar as the last four or so, e.g. very permissive of quite a lot of so-called like woke culture war stuff. This sort of politics might come back in England in a more powerful way. And in Wales, of course, by virtue of the same sort of, there's no cash for anything. We need to be loud. Let's support the London Mayor renaming the tube lines the Lioness Line or something like that. Or do some remarkable situation like you just described, where Humza Yousaf was saying that it's appalling that there are so many white people in Scotland or thereabouts.
And I mean, it's funny because Scotland has been a sort of test case or laboratory for terrible authoritarian ideas. All of them seem to blow up in the SNP's face eventually. You know, the Hate Crime Act seems as if it's been almost neutered successfully by J.K. Rowling at this point.
Yeah, it's, just, it's kind of collapsed under the weight of its own ridiculousness. Yeah. When it, what, they had like 7,000 complaints in the course of the first week. Humza Yousaf is the biggest alleged hate criminal in all of Scotland at this point because of that white speech that he gave in a country that is 96% white. So it's, you shouldn't have really been that surprised. But it was telling because this has been the SNP's raison d'etre since they came to power. Yes, they've been campaigning for independence. Yes, they got scarily close in that referendum back in 2015. But it was also the fact that they were, from the off, obsessed with these issues of culture of social engineering of authoritarianism. One of the first things they do is to pass bans on offensive chanting at football. That's one of their kind of set piece policies that then gets rolled back eventually. They tried and failed to introduce the name person scheme, which everyone's sort of forgotten about now. But this genuinely Orwellian attempt to assign a state guardian to every child born in Scotland.
Yeah.
Incredibly chilling, ended up getting caught, you know, held up in the courts effectively.
They would want to know whether how your child's room is decorated,
yeah.
What television programs they watch, in case people were unsure about how sinister this
Absolutely.
Plan was.
And then, of course, then you move into gender self-ID and the hate crime legislation. It's like this movement that is supposed to liberate Scotland, but it doesn't trust Scots to raise their own children or tie their own shoelaces or walk down the road without being overcome by the hate monster.
Or buy 2-for-1 pizza.
And all the lifestyle stuff.
Minimum pricing.
Yeah.
The smacking ban that we're debating
everything
here at the moment, you know, that was passed in 2019.
But this is a feature, not a bug, I think. Yeah. There's this thing about kind of technocratic centre-left, but not always, politics, which is to say that the reason that we are in government is to improve the public. And I think they're a perfect example of that. And I think a lot of people in Scotland, and Ian McWhirter's piece on Spike this week makes this point quite powerfully, is that what was presented to them as, you know, Scottish solutions to Scottish problems, and this is a way in which devolution will really mean that the bread and butter issues are properly dealt with in a way that faraway Westminster can't.
Yeah.
It's just become from the off a project of how can we make you horrible, racist, child-beating lot slightly better. And they haven't got a lot to show for it as a consequence.
Do you think they get away with it, Charlie, because they pose as anti-English, but really the target of all their laws are Scots?
I think they pose more often as diplomats. The way that they're treated when they come to London or when they're treated in the English media is really quite remarkable, because they're treated as emissaries from a foreign country. There isn't the same level of political criticism and engagement with the media that you might get from, let's say, I don't know, Plaid in Wales. You get this sort of approach that we're speaking to the Home Secretary from Latvia, so let's not pry too aggressively into their domestic policies, because who are we to criticise a foreign nation? And yeah, they're treated as if they are representatives from a foreign land. And I think there's a reason why perhaps we don't get very many SNP moments in the media for right-leaning platforms. GB News in particular often struggles to hear from the SNP, perhaps because they anticipate that the questioning might be a bit more direct than what they anticipate
elsewhere.
Well, there might be a few more questions than they're usually used to. And I know that the media in Scotland is a bit more pugnacious, but I think by and large, people don't have the same understanding of what the SNP is actually up to across the rest of the United Kingdom.
At Spiked, we know that plenty of you would love to have more freedom over your work. Imagine finally setting your own hours, doing things your own way, and being your own boss. But starting your own business can be a struggle. The good news, though, is that there's a way to make it nearly effortless. And it sounds like this. Yes, that's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the revolutionary all-in-one commerce platform that helps you make your big idea a reality. Shopify supports business owners like you across the globe. Whether you trade in window panes or model trains, Shopify can simplify how you sell goods, both online and in person. Getting started has never been this easy. Shopify brings your whole business under one simple online hub. This makes managing goods and taking payments simple. That gives you the time to focus on growing your business instead of getting bogged down in the basics. Shopify also launches your business on those all-important social media marketplaces, from Facebook to TikTok. Regardless of who your customers are, Shopify will help you get them interested. And don't worry about losing your independence either. Shopify's variety of business courses help you carve out your own path. And Shopify's extensive tools help you constantly tweak and expand your website without having to become an expert in coding. Whatever direction you want to take, the choice is entirely yours. So why wait? If you want to ditch the 9-to-5, get started with Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/spiked. Go to shopify.co.uk/spiked to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/spiked. The comedian Joe Lycett has come out in praise of cancel culture because apparently it is making comedy more inclusive, more refined, more thoughtful. Let's have a look at this clip.
What is cancel culture's impact on comedy? I think that people are more thoughtful about what they write jokes about, and I think that's a good thing. I think really it's made it a better industry and a more inclusive and interesting industry.
Charlie, isn't this a bit easy for Joe Lycett to say? I mean, if you tell jokes about, I don't know, cheese or something, then you're probably not going to get cancelled anytime soon.
I think it's remarkable that he's made that, despite the fact that he has made jokes about cheese and has still been put on the pedestal for public and indeed police opprobrium. I mean, in 2022, Joe Lycett put on a gig in Belfast and someone reported him for having an offensive joke about a donkey, of all things. I think that's on the same tier as cheese, as not being a particularly controversial area of comedy. And
I think it's late enough in the podcast that we can say this, but it's donkey dick, wasn't it? I think that was
right.
Specific.
Well, there we go. Yeah, you did swear earlier, so we'll rock that.
No, exactly. There's rules to this.
Yeah. No Ofcom here, Charlie.
Yeah, no. Liberated.
Not that ever stops you.
Come on now. Well, the police service in Northern Ireland turned up. They investigated. They interviewed him and they said they had to do it. And it seems remarkable.
Is that not one of his fake stories that he implanted? That's always what I've got in the back of my mind.
Well, he actually, in that, I've watched the whole thing as preparation for this podcast. And he says that he adds a bit more context, again, how much of this is also a prank, but he claims that he'd superimposed a picture of a donkey's penis over a picture of him as a child.
Right.
So maybe that would raise it to that extra level of ick that led someone to make a complaint, but who knows if it's true.
A joke's a joke. Still, the fact of the matter is he faced a police investigation insofar as he was questioned, as is claimed, at the time. And to go through that process and say that cancel culture isn't so much of an issue, I think you have to really reflect quite intensely on what could have happened to you in that situation. And I think people talk all the time about how, you know, cancel culture isn't about the force of the state. The real concern is how it's those societal impulses that lead comics and writers and thinkers to second guess. Mm. And that's certainly a massive part of it. And, you know, Simon Evans has written about this for Spike this week. But I think also we really shouldn't ignore the extent to which the state can cause that second guessing as well.
Yeah.
He's faced it himself. And I think when he's making these arguments, he should acknowledge that.
Maybe if it was a trans woman's donkey dick, then he would be behind bars, but who knows?
It wasn't in Scotland.
Tom, I mean, there have been, you know, some very brutal cancellations in comedy. You know, this is not a non-issue.
No, I was reminded of this because Daniel O'Reilly, aka Dapper Laughs, people might remember him, about just under 10 years ago, he actually put out a response to this particular clip, but it's something we covered at the time. That was a really good example because this was a really brutal cancellation, so people can read and relitigate all of it, but he basically got cancelled for making a joke on stage that he hadn't actually made. So he was this sort of lad character, this kind of lad comedian. He had a BBC Three TV show.
ITV2,
sorry.
Oi, oi.
Fraser's president of the fan club. Yeah. Tried and failed to be a contestant. Really, so. But he had this show where he, you know, in character teach men how to get women or whatever. Mm. And there was this kind of low-level campaign to say he was disgusting and like something needs to be done about him. And then he was on stage and then he was talking about how the media had slurred him as this pro-rape comedian, and someone shouted out from, basically made a kind of rape joke from the audience, essentially. He repeated it after hearing it, and then he got cancelled for making this supposed rape joke. So it wasn't even anything that he'd said himself. Yeah. Brutally cancelled. You know, he lost his show. You know, he had venues being pulled for his tour and so on. He ends up having to make this bizarre... he feels inclined to make this bizarre apology on Newsnight to Emily Maitlis.
People will remember his roll neck.
No, exactly. Yeah. Like, really put through the ringer, especially because people... took offence not just to what he had said, because he hadn't actually said it, but also because of the fact that people saw him as this working class comedian with a working class audience, and therefore they can't stand this kind of blue material. They'll go out and act on it, they'll be overly exercised by it, and that's a big problem. So there have been so many cases of this. I mean, in recent times, you know, Jerry Sadowitz being cancelled at the Edinburgh Fringe, a slightly more worthy example. And also, this is the point that Simon Evans makes in his piece, is that sometimes you're missing a trick by focusing too much on the ones that make the news, because obviously the bigger problem is further down the food chain. Yeah. People who are doing open mics, people who are just starting out, who are quite clearly under the cosh. If they stray out of what are supposedly the safe parameters, they're going to be punished for it. And that's the unseen cost of cancel culture. But I think it just comes down to that thing that it's always the case that the people who say cancel culture don't exist, or that free speech isn't really under threat, It's always people in politics or people in culture or people in comedy who have never said anything interesting or challenging or in some cases funny in their life. That's why. That's largely why they don't feel touched by it, is because of the fact that they will never really be a target of it, the odd visit from the police over some strange donkey situation notwithstanding. But that's what it comes down to. They know that they're not the targets of it, therefore they can deny it till the cows come home.
Definitely. Charlie, final thoughts?
People can get away with it now because technology permits comedians to have alternate ways of being offensive and still making money. There is no shortage of comics who've made it online through social media, who have not gone through the mainstream route anymore, partly because it doesn't really exist as much, and now make their living by maybe fishing a little bit with, here's a clip I put out online, and then if you want to see the real stuff, here's £5 a month. I'm playing £5 a month for a lot of good comics who can't put out stuff publicly.
And it's all like Roy Chubby Brown and
all the good stuff.
He was telling me about this before the show. I don't want to out you there, but no.
All those chalky jokes.
I knew I'd get cooked between you two. I knew it was going to be bleak, this one. But you have to. So many comedians who I think aren't bothering to go there on this argument, aren't wanting to fight back on the Joe license of this world, because they don't really need to. They don't really need to be risky in public anymore, because they can sort of advertise that there might be slightly stronger wares behind the paywall.
Yeah.
And you can get around this cancel culture because Lycett and his mob aren't going to see it. Case in point, recently, there's a guy, you might watch him occasionally, Finn versus the Internet, Finn Taylor, have you seen his?
Yeah.
Very funny. He had on his Patreon on the full episode, someone from that extremely strange sort of like Irish activist website, Politics Joe, as one of the guests. And this guest laughed at a really funny joke about Joe, who's the best Joe, and one of the Joes was Joseph Fritzl. It was pretty funny. I'm not going to lie, it got me, it tickled me. And he laughed, and because it went out on their main public section, he then was the target of no shortage of those. That's actually really offensive. That's actually so bad. How could you laugh at that tweet from his own team, as is the way. But since then, I've noticed that way more of Finn's divine content has been limited to the paywall only.
Yeah.
Because they've realized we can still get away with it. People can see what's good. And they'll come paying.
The fans don't mind. It's the I think Simon Evans puts it really well in his article. It's like that sort of the imaginary third party, right, that you kind of have to think about and second guess about all the time.
The comic consents, I consent, but does that angry strange woman on Twitter consent to this joke? No, you're going to get absolutely pilloried. Why bother?
Thank you so much for watching the Spikes podcast. We'll be back next Friday. If you hit subscribe and click the bell, you'll never miss an episode. And in the meantime, why not check out all of Spiked's other videos and podcasts on this channel? And for more Spiked content, find us at spiked-online.com.